You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Hi, good evening again. Welcome to OSI. My name is Masha Feginova, and I'm the program coordinator for the Turkmenistan Project here at Open Society Institute. Thank you for coming to the screening of the book. Let's see. Just a few words about the Turkmenistan project. We are part of the Central Eurasia project here at OSI, which covers the countries of the Caucasus, Central Asia, and Mongolia. And the three principal activities of our project is to broaden opportunities for Turkmen citizens to study and to integrate more fully into international development and civil society. It's to provide full information about the situation inside the country through independent research and media outreach, and to promote government accountability and good governance through policy work, media outreach, and targeted advocacy. And of course, this event, the screening of the film, is part of this larger last objective. The Turkmenistan Project operates programmatic activities and grant-making to organizations run by Turkmenistani civil society activists, to international watchdog and advocacy organizations. We also work on policy level with intergovernmental organizations, with NGOs, and with donors. Whenever possible, we try to galvanize demand for reform by raising awareness of civil society concerns more broadly through media and information outreach. We felt it was very important to show a film that highlights the human rights violations and constraints on the work of civil society under the late President Niyazov, as well as the support that Western companies offer this regime. And we felt it was timely to show the event now, because the regime of the current president, President Berdimuhamedov, which celebrates its 2 years in power earlier this month, has demonstrated that the power dynamics between the president and civil society and the president of business community have not changed drastically. But we will hear more about these points after the film presentation, which is about 55 minutes from our panelists, which are, in the order of being seated, is Lisa Misol, who is a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch Business and Human Rights Program. It's Farid Tupatulin, who's a director of the independent NGO Turkmen Initiative for Human Rights. It's Arto Halonen, who's the director of the film, and Kevin Fraser, who's the co-screenwriter. So enjoy the film, and we'll see you in a bit.
I hope you enjoyed the film. I think it was very revealing in many ways. I want to take a few moments to comment on some of the broad themes that are raised in the film. As Masha had mentioned, I work on business and human rights issues, so you won't be surprised that I want to really tease out some of the themes that arose in the film that sadly we don't find are unique to Turkmenistan, although the ways in which they manifest are clearly quite special there. But a broader issue that clearly comes out in the film that we see in many countries that are rich in natural resources is how this wealth, this natural wealth, translates into economic power that is divorced from political legitimacy. And in the case of Turkmenistan, the enormous revenues from oil and gas exports, which are slated to increase, really reinforces unaccountable political power, because the leaders, whoever is in charge, doesn't need to draw political support from the populace because they can count on the revenue that's coming in to bankroll their rule. And they can use those funds to, in effect, buy support from the people whose support they find is useful. And they also use that money to finance an apparatus of repression to shut down critics who would want to raise questions about the way the government is acting. And the cycle feeds on itself because the rulers get very wealthy, as you see, basically treating the country's natural resources as their own personal bank accounts to finance any projects that strike their whim. And so they have a really strong incentive to stay in power. So the more money comes in, the more they want to hang on to control, and then the more that they can finance the repression to shut down any opposition. The other issue that comes through very clearly in the film is the fact that this economic leverage doesn't just exist domestically in terms of quieting critics, but also internationally, that other governments and indeed companies don't want to rock the boat because they have an interest in those natural resources as well. It's kind of a strategic interest that bolsters the political power of these tyrants. The role of companies is showcased in very interesting ways in the film, and I wanted to take a few moments to reflect on that, because we do find in many different contexts, including resource-rich countries, that businesses contribute to the cycle of revenue and repression. And they can do so in a variety of different ways. What's clear in the film is how very eager companies are to get access to contracts, get access certainly to the natural resources themselves, but this wealth creates lots of opportunities in many areas. And so they want to curry favor with the people who hold power. And it's very evident that human rights considerations are not at the forefront, and they're actually not in mind at all as companies seek to pursue these potential opportunities. And so they partner up with repressive regimes in a variety of ways. We see the financing of vanity projects, there's also allegations about more direct involvement in repression and so forth. And as you saw again at the end with some of those quotes from company statements, the kinds of companies that do this include some companies who would profess to have much higher standards. And that divergence between the pledges that companies make and their actual practices is something that sadly is quite common. And so the fact that companies have human rights policies sadly doesn't mean very much. Because they can be empty promises. There's nothing backing them up. And this is something that that we encounter very frequently in conversations with companies who don't even recognize that the kinds of things you saw in the film actually have human rights impacts, are sort of invisible to them. And that's why a film like this plays such an important role in exposing those impacts, in calling companies out on the promises they made, and helping to bring some scrutiny to this cycle of repression and financing that the rulers won't allow any sort of transparency about. That they want to keep that quiet, and films like this can really bring it to a broader audience and help to increase pressure on external actors, governments, companies, and others, to really change the way that they approach a government like Turkmenistan. And so with that, I just wanted to pass the baton, as it were, to hear a little bit more about some of the other aspects of the film. But just please keep in mind that as special as the Rukhnuma is, it really in some ways is emblematic of the kind of dynamics of power that a rich ruler can engage in.
Yes, very nice to be here, and very different audience, like 2 days ago in MoMA. But also, we have always Ruhna with us, you know. That's kind of important part of the traveling with the film, you know, that we have the information with us. From the filmmaker's point of view, it's always difficult to know at once, you know, what you can reach with the film, you know. Even you have a great subject, even you can work with the great people like Farid and Kevin. But then, as a result, you never know. And we have been very lucky with this film in many ways, because it was one of the three most troubling films in the whole world in documentaries. And that has gave us a lot of opportunity to talk about this subject. And there is like two important subjects in the film we are focusing through the film, and also the spreading information, of course, the situation of Turkmenistan, which hasn't unfortunately changed even with the Peri Muhammedov's time. And then another thing about our own ethical responsibility, and how our Western companies are part of this, supporting the dictatorships and make them even worse and more dangerous and more effective. And we've been happy also that the film has sold all of the major TV channels around the world in US, Germany, Germany, France, and 20 others, which gives these possibilities that people will know about Turkmenistan. Because always this funniest thing and strangest thing, you know, after the screenings and after meeting people, that no one hasn't know anything about Turkmenistan. It's always the kind of thing, and it was many festivals, many screenings, people felt that this is fake documentary, this cannot be true, you know, this country does not exist. And then as long as we're going with the film, they finally start to believe that this is, and the Cuban people keep saying that, why our government hasn't told us about Turkmenistan? Maybe because we have a similar society. Maybe they keep information out from us. And that's something important to find out, you know, with the film. And as I said, this has been great achievement and great thing for the filmmaker when you do something and you don't know exactly in the beginning what's going to happen. In Finland, we had unfortunate situation with the big cell phone company Nokia. I'm sure many of you know this company, and they made a joint venture together with the Siemens with the networks and started to work also in Turkmenistan. Even we warned them like 2 years ahead, and we explained what Siemens has done in Turkmenistan. And the worst thing what Siemens has done there, that is they've been supplying the surveillance system and spying system for the people, and now Nokia is clearly part of this spying people. But in the other hand, this was the great thing in Finland, which put a lot of kind of press coverage around and a lot of kind of articles was written, and finally Finnish Foreign Ministry started to kind of project which investigated Finnish companies' ethical values in abroad. And it's been published like three weeks ago now, and it also tells that our film started this project. And this is very interesting group of people who's been doing this this approach and this research. And it's Martti Koskeniemi who is the kind of leading human rights, leading lawyer of the international law, we could say, in Finland. And also he's part of the UN and different important committees. And he said very interesting way that he's been trying to 30 years to convince, you know, different institutes, different countries that companies should not create the human rights situation and affections, you know, in different countries, you know, companies shouldn't create their own ethical principles because they never follow them. And that's why it's a big question to taking this power out from them to the governments and to the UN. And that's something we've been trying to influence also with the film and also with the book, which is written together with Kevin, and I think so Kevin can continue from this.
Yeah, let me just tell a little bit more about the Nokia situation, because I think it illustrates very well many of the things that you were talking about. Back in 2004, Amnesty International issued a report saying very specifically that mobile phone companies should not be doing business with the Turkmen dictatorship because automatically their work would be made part of the surveillance system. And in particular, they criticized Siemens for creating the surveillance system in Turkmenistan. They also contacted Siemens, and Siemens said, oh my God, we had no idea. We had no idea that our work was being used for the dictatorship. This, of course, was ridiculous. They'd been working there for already 3 years, and they clearly knew what they were doing. And one of the ways that we know that they knew what they were doing is that immediately after promising that they wouldn't do it and saying that they were sorry, they went back and started updating the system again. Then in 2007, in February 2007, Nokia Siemens Networks, which is a joint venture between Nokia and Siemens, announced that it would also be working on updating the mobile system and providing equipment for the mobile system, which inevitably will become part of the surveillance system. When Arto got this information, he told the Helsingin Sanomat, the main newspaper in Finland, about it. The newspaper did its own independent investigation and wrote an article about it, and it became a kind of controversy in Finland. At that point, Nokia issued a denial saying that there was nothing that they were doing that could possibly assist the dictatorship in any way. I think it's very typical of the way that corporations act in this situation. They rely very heavily on the ignorance of the public about Turkmenistan. Arto and I are not in any way anti-corporate, and we realize that there are very complex issues in the ethical standards, but the corporations themselves are trying to oversimplify the issues in a kind of public relations manner that is simply not acceptable. It's not acceptable to pretend that there isn't any kind of human rights issue in Turkmenistan. And in fact, this is what the companies do as a matter of course. And of course, we tried to illustrate that in the film. I think it's a bit frustrating to watch me. It's certainly frustrating for me to watch myself on the phone with the corporations. But there's a serious point behind it, which is that the corporations simply have, as a matter of their everyday course, denial of the existence of the human rights situation because they know that most people will not have any access to that kind of information. And for that reason, that again is how come the Finnish government has issued this report that that encourages the government to create tougher oversight of corporate ethical standards. Because right now, as you said, the ethical standards exist, but not only are they not meaningless, in a way they're worse than meaningless, because they provide a kind of smokescreen. They give the public the illusion that corporations are taking their ethical codes seriously. And of course, in some cases they are. Life is complicated. Anybody who's been on the board of a corporation knows there's lots of different kinds of people with different viewpoints. But in many, many situations, the ethical codes are simply used as a mask to give the illusion of concern about ethical issues and to hide the actual activity. And so for that reason, we were happy that the Finnish government took a different approach and came out in favor of what seems to be a kind of increasing awareness that kind of mandatory ethical guidelines or oversight of corporations on ethical issues is sort of a sensible idea. Just one other thing briefly, I'll say all of the U.S. corporations that we talk about in the film, all of them continue to work in Turkmenistan to this day. All of them continue to refuse to give any kind of recognition to even the possibility of a human rights problem there. And in fact, with the start of the Berdimuhamedov regime, Berdimuhamedov has hired 3 different PR agencies in the United States to represent him to help improve his public image. And if you look at newspaper accounts, you see quite a few articles about reforms, changes that are there. The New York Times recently had one. What was it, back at the time I was writing the book, so I guess it would have been more towards the end of August, because I think it was right at the end before we went into print. There was one about the new constitution and changes. I don't know. I wish to God I knew, and if there is anybody who does know, I'd be happy to talk to them. So, please let me know if you have any information about it. Yeah. we would like to find out.
Yeah, by the way, we have left, you know, on the table over there, you know, some updated information about the U.S. companies and Turkmen relationship nowadays as well. There is the flyers of the website, which is kind of a human rights website in Turkmenistan.
Let me just say one last thing, and I'll pass it over to Farid. Ahmet Çalık, one of the things we didn't deal with in the film because we basically just focused on connections to the Runama book is that Çalık has been the gatekeeper for American oil companies like Parker Drilling and Schlumberger, which do a lot of work in Turkmenistan. So there is that kind of strong connection with this issue of the natural gas. Well, if we talk about that kind of thing much more in the book because the book is 400 pages and we had time to go into it, but obviously in a film, you have to concentrate on making a few clear points.
Just let you know that Çalık has both kind of media power over his own country in Turkey recently, so he's kind of the Berlusconi of Turkey nowadays, and he made it with the money he earned from Turkmenistan.
I will speak in Russian because my English very bad, like myself. For Turkmen government.
As has been mentioned here already, the movie is not so much for Turkmenistan, but the problem of transparency in business in general. Nonetheless, the movie has been in many international film festivals and has helped show the situation in which Turkmen citizens are currently residing, living. Unfortunately, a new generation has already grown up, a generation of children who have been raised on this book, the Ruhnama. And the reform that the new president has talked about implementing is always comes up against the fact that there are not enough people to perform the reform because the generation has already been inculcated with this new book, with the information that they've been raised on in this book.
Что касается реальных изменений, например, в сфере бизнеса, работают те же компании, которые переводили эту книгу.
In terms of changes with business, nothing realistically has, no changes have occurred. The same companies who have translated these books are still currently, the same companies that used to work with Niyazov are working with the new president.
Единственная новая крупная компания.
The only new company is a big, large Russian company, Kamaz, who have managed to translate the Ruhnama last year very quickly into the Tatar language. I'm hoping that this will be the last translation of Ruhnama.
Но что-то мне подсказывает, что теперь будут.
But I have a suspicion that the new translations are going to be of the book of the new president. So unfortunately, the situation has not changed. No major changes have occurred, including with the human rights, the situation with human rights.
И когда в конце фильма показывали.
So towards the end of the movie, where they showed the doors of the jails, jail cells slamming shut, it reminds me of the people who I spent time in prison with, and unfortunately, they are still being held, still being detained. And this is partly the fault or the responsibility of those companies who were shown in the film. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure there are many of you who would like to make comments from the floor and ask questions of the panelists. I would invite you to use the microphones here, and please remember to give your name and your organizational affiliation, please. We're going to take a couple of questions at a time, just in light of the time. So we'll take two questions, have responses, and go back for two more questions. The two of you were the ones I saw first. If you could please use a microphone. Thank you.
It seems to me, with the kind of experience I had, and we see in Iraq or any other Muslim country, we have two choices. Either we have to go with, just to look at it from the, you know, internal point of view, and then we deal with the West on that. We either have to have dictators who are secular, at least let us breathe a little bit, especially for women. I don't have to cover my hair. Or we have to go, in other words, we have to go with the Ruhnameh. Is it Ruhnameh or Rahnameh? Either way, Ruhnameh. Or we have to go with the Sharia law. So that's our two choices there, which is not much of a choice, because to me it's both the same. At least I, at this point, I'd rather have the first one rather than the latter. The second thing is that I think we should just blame the West for not wanting us having a democracy, meaning separation of mosque and state. Because if we become a serious democratic nation, then there is no way for them, meaning the West, to have the kind of business and abuse and, you know, the money laundry and all of the things that we have in our nation. So we don't have that much of a choice. Either way we go, we have the human rights abuse, and we are seeing it right now in Iran and many other countries for that. So what do you think the solution would be, since we cannot separate our Islam with the government?
We're going to take a second question. Again, the gentleman in the corduroy jacket, please. Name and affiliation, please, and
okay,
if you could
Peter
keep
Pauly,
the question
long-term
brief.
Volunteer. I've been in Turkmenistan. I have a question about distribution of this film. You have a problem that is pretty intractable and has been for a long time and probably always will be, or certainly for a long period in the future. Have you considered the distribution of this film to the business schools, which seem to be in a position that have, through absence, not discussed any of these issues, as we can see from this present economic crisis and previous crises?
I say something shortly for the first question, and Kevin and Farid can continue. I think sort of each countries are really individual, and we have a lot of problems in everywhere, and especially in these Central Asian countries, and it's a very big question, you know. Are we really using this opportunity, you know, and hiding with this mock kind of strains, you know, the way, you know, our actions, you know, and decrease, you know, the whole human things what we have. And I think so the most important thing for us is spread the information and individually evaluate each country what we are able to do there, and trying to also to create kind of the system which stop our possibilities, at least to limit the possibilities to support the dictatorship and make them stronger. By the way, we had a screening also in Tehran, which was very surprising that they took the film over there in the festival, and after we screened the film there, people in the audience, they tried to convince us that we need to make the next film about their spiritual leader. and I was happy to say that maybe we just brought in kind of the feeling of an inspiration that you can do it by yourself. About this distribution thing, we've been approached many business schools with the film, and also we've been kind of offering the package that we're screening the film and having the lecture together with the Kevin, and there has been few schools which has been interesting to do it, but so far not so many of them. So, but I agree that that's really something we should work on, and we're trying to concentrate more. And I'm sure now when in this year it's going to be screened in Sundance Channel here in US, in the big TV channels in Germany and France, we will get more and more opportunities to work with the business schools also in the future, because that's in the future, it's something business people are concerned. They want to live, you know, in the next level, and they realize that if they want to survive, they need to act in a bit different way.
And I was just going to say, it's an interesting and important question, this idea of these two bad choices, two bad alternatives. I would say that because we've made bad choices in the past doesn't limit us in the future. And I think that both of those choices between those two bad alternatives are a result of people not thinking through more subtle possibilities. I'm an American. I grew up in San Francisco, but I've lived in Europe for many years now. And as a lawyer in Europe, I teach European law courses at different universities there. And one of the things that I find fascinating to watch is the way that the European Union has step by step absorbed different countries with different kinds of human rights problems over the years. Sometimes it's been very successful. Sometimes it's not been very successful, but the process has always been very different from this either-or choice that you're suggesting. It's been a kind of a subtle setting of different possible goalposts for the countries to meet with different deadlines, different milestones, and step by step, year by year, these countries become part of the European Union, and for the most part, it's been pretty successful. I would say that we're seeing one of the most fascinating examples, an example much closer to Turkmenistan than anything so far, but still milder, is the process with Turkey right now. Turkey is in the process of trying to figure out, and the European Union is trying to figure out, how the country can join. And it's not simple. It's not at all simple. It's unbelievably complicated. And anybody who pretends that it's an either-or kind of thing, that either this choice or that choice is going to work best, that's the wrong approach. But I would say that it is both theoretically possible and demonstrated in practice that a more effective approach, an approach that does take human rights very clearly into account, can succeed in a practical level. And that's what we would hope for Turkmenistan's future, recognizing that it's very difficult and perhaps not very likely in the short run.
Reid, would you like to comment?
Конечно, очень много схожего есть у Туркменистана и Ирана.
Of course, there are a lot of aspects that are similar between Turkmenistan and Iran.
Хотя, конечно, в Туркменистане внутри нет оппозиции, нет негосударственных печатных изданий.
Although in Turkmenistan there is no opposition inside the country currently, there are no press, non-government affiliated press.
Но в то же время, когда говоришь с западными дипломатами или с другими влиятельными людьми, они, в принципе, спрашивают, хорошо, мы бы, например, готовы были кого-то поддержать, но кого нам в Туркменистане поддерживать? Там же нет оппозиции.
At the same time, when you speak to people, to government leaders from other countries or to other influential individuals, and you speak to them about the situation in Turkmenistan, and they might say, okay, fine, we will help, but who do we support? There is no opposition. Who do we get behind?
Они в какой-то мере, конечно, правы, но когда вот эта книга порождает невежество у целого поколения, действительно ожидать, что вдруг придет тот, кого можно было бы поддержать, такой ситуации уже не будет.
And of course, to some extent, they're correct. But when you have a whole generation that is raised in ignorance based on this book, it's very hard to expect, or it's maybe folly to expect someone that is going to come after being raised on this book and form an opposition.
Хотя с ними трудно не согласиться, ребенок не заплачет, грудь не получит. То есть пока не возникнет потребность в самом Туркменистане, в народе Туркменистана, то поддержка извне, наверное, особого значения.
Although it's hard not to agree with them, we have a saying in Turkmenistan where until the child starts to cry, he's not going to be fed, he's not going to be given the breast, something to the extent of the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And so until there is someone in Turkmenistan who is calling for support for some sort of change, then it's hard not to agree with them that they don't know who to support. Thank you.
We want to take two questions from the back. You will need to come forward in order to speak into the microphone. Yes, the two woman in the hat and the woman with the scarf, please. And I believe only the front microphone has been turned on.
Okay. My name is Kristen Romy. I'm an independent journalist. And one thing, I understand that it's very difficult to get companies to not simplify their approach to ethics in business. At the same time, there's a frustration for people who don't understand Turkmenistan to only know it as the desert country with the crazy guy with the spiraling golden statue and the month named after his mother. However, what I'd love to see discussed here is that the two critical issues right now going on with Turkmenistan are you have the energy issue primarily with the Nabucco pipeline. And with the increasing concern about what's going on with Russia and their role with the pipelines going into Europe, I'd love to know, for instance, does Jalik have any sort of stake in the development of the Nabucco pipeline? Does Siemens have a role in the development of the Nabucco pipeline? Because for all the crap that Siemens gets for being in Turkey, it's not worth for them to be there if they're simply providing Turkmenistan with surveillance equipment. There's got to be more to it than that. So for a lot of these countries, they're waiting for the big pipelines that are going to bypass Russia. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. Number two is the ongoing military campaign in Southwest Asia. It's been going on since 2001. And when you look at it, you have the U.S. base shut down in Karshi. You have the U.S. base being shut down in Kyrgyzstan. You have a resupply of allied bases that's going to helm Pakistan. So right now, the U.S. is really, really looking at Turkmenistan as a huge open front for coming into Afghanistan and opening for fighting in that area, particularly if they're going to move in another 30,000 troops like Obama wants. And I think that's a very, very important issue to look at, not as an excuse for what is going on in Turkmenistan right now, but as a reason why the stakes are so high and why these businesses are willing to come crawling to whomever is running the country right now and translating whatever they want and doing whatever they want, because they know down the road that there's going to be a very, very nice payoff. And for that, we need to present these complicated issues to the public to let them know that it's not just this crazy dictator that businessmen want to throw some money at in return for, you know, a $10 or $20 million contract. So.
Thanks. Would you come forward with your question, please?
Yes. Hi, I'm Catherine Fitzpatrick. I work with the Turkmenistan Project and also with Physicians for Human Rights at the UN. And I wanted to make a comment and a question. First of all, I think that what's very important to accentuate about this film is the journalist and their attempt to try to get the story and how impossible that really is and how creative you have to be and what sort of fragile networks you have to depend on, like Farid's. Because, I mean, we're dealing with the State Department now saying that Rahnama has been somewhat put in abeyance, which it has. I mean, technically, it's not the requirement that it once was, even though it's still ubiquitous. I mean, it's even in internet cafes, we're told, you know, where there's instructions for how to use, be inspired by Rahnama as you log on, you know. But I think what I would caution, I know Martin Sheen and I've worked with him for years. I would caution trying to mount an exercise that involves having the UN attempt to negotiate and adopt ethics that you then have to try to apply to private enterprise and domestic in democratic countries, because that whole process is filled with many bad actors, including Turkmenistan itself. You would have to be dealing with the same countries that are busy putting in the global blasphemy law, for example. So you know, this exercise of, let's have the UN enforce this is fraught with lots of problems that would affect freedom of association and democracy and so on. I wonder if another tact is to, through U.S. law and EU regulations that have to do with, I mean, you know, there are regulations that have to do with bribe giving abroad, that have to do with labor law, with, you know, the Sullivan Act, the GSP. I mean, they're hard to work. They're, you have to get hearings. You have to get people interested. But I wonder, two aspects of this. One, the oil companies, we're talking a lot about them, but the reality is the internationals haven't broken ground there. I mean, it's China and Russia, where we have the least access possibly to the information. But that gives us actually an opportunity to, I wonder if it does, to say, you know, publicize the production sharing agreements and trying to get domestic movements to publicize these agreements that, you know, that a Shell or whatever would put in. The other aspect is these huge construction deals. I mean, these are huge boondoggles that cover up lots of money spent on all sides. And I wonder if we can't get at those budgets, making those transparent, comparing them to what they say in France, what they say in Turkmenistan, because, you know, even just looking at the official press, you can find all kinds of contradictions and weird things to follow up. So I'm just wondering if those, you know, the oil is sort of a bigger task than the labor construction angle that I think you could work with France, Turkey, U.S., so on. Thanks.
Great. Well, I find interesting how in part you answered each other's questions a little bit, which is useful because we are running short on time. The event's scheduled to end at 7. We can linger on for a few more minutes after that. Masha tells me we can hang on for as long as 15 minutes. We understand, of course, that some of you need to go. Perhaps I'll take a first stab at these points. Certainly the pipeline is an incredibly important issue in terms of what's going on in Turkmenistan and the region, and plays into energy politics involving many countries. And that is... It does indeed motivate a lot of the interest in Turkmenistan, not just by companies, but by foreign governments. And yet the same, and I should mention that there's a gas field that is predicted to have very large reserves, and so there are a lot of companies vying for access to that. And so a lot of Western companies are actually trying to lay the groundwork for contracts down the road. And so certainly that's part of what's going on, but as was also stated, at the moment, oil and gas are being sold, you know, Russia, Iran, and so forth. So it's a complicated picture with a lot of actors involved. And a lot of money at stake, and more money at stake in the future, as well as even greater strategic interests potentially at stake in the future. On the question of UN standards and whether those would be useful, I think it's a bigger issue, but I do want to take a moment just to say that having international standards on business ethics that clearly cover human rights and detail them in some way, from what I've seen, is actually quite essential because it answers the question of companies that say, well, we had no reason to think that there were any human rights issues here. No one told us to look out for them. And we don't see the human rights impacts on freedom of the press from our own work. And having some reference point, I think, would answer that in part. The question of enforceability, I think, was nicely brought out in that you need to have that complemented by efforts by governments. The corruption, anti-corruption, anti-bribery model is actually something that many of us in the business and human rights field are looking at closely. There are important intersections, and the way those laws are enforced overseas is quite telling. There's recently a settlement involving corruption in Nigeria, and companies have had to pay up and admit to responsibility in a way that we haven't seen on the human rights front, but we can always look for examples to follow. So rather general remarks, I wanted to open it up to others to comment on those points as well. Thank you.
Maybe more specifically for the question of Çalık and whether Çalık is involved with the pipelines. Yes, he is. Not with Nabucco directly, but with one of the other pipelines that would tie in with Nabucco. And interestingly enough, both the Trans-Caspian and this Çalık pipeline would require working with Georgia. So there's definitely a kind of question about how deeply the recent conflict between Russia and Georgia involves these pipeline issues, and they are quite complicated and very much at the heart of why it's difficult to work with Turkmenistan, because everybody wants the oil and gas there. Right now, for Europeans, the fact that Turkmenistan gives almost 100% of its gas to Gazprom allows Gazprom to continue its monopoly over providing natural gas to the EU. And that, of course, gives Russia tremendous leverage in negotiations with the EU, and it complicates the picture immensely. I also wanted to say something about the UN standards issue, because I agree completely that that if you have some kind of – there's no magical UN set of rules that are going to fix things, but I think that's maybe a little bit of a – that's not the way international law works anyway. International law, I think maybe the bribery example is a good one. The one that I also always use that I actually think is very close is intellectual property rights. The Berne Convention has existed since, I think, 1898. And it is kind of a set of general principles that almost every country in the world has signed on to for intellectual property rights. What are intellectual property rights? They were defined over a century ago. But in reality, it's state by state, territory by territory, that gives the power to those general principles. And when the Berne Convention was first created, it didn't have much power. It didn't work very much. My home country, the United States, was notorious for stealing all of the literary works of people from other countries. Dickens went crazy because he couldn't get any money from his novels from the United States, even though we read all of them here. But nowadays, of course, the intellectual property rules are widely recognized and widely enforced. Not everywhere. Certainly in places like Russia and China, there's still issues, but it doesn't mean that the approach can't work. So again, I think corporations often like to emphasize the difficulties in creating international standards, but as somebody whose entire career has been doing international contracts and international situations, if it was really that hard, nobody would ever be able to do any kind of business agreement anywhere at any time. So I think that the difficulties are exaggerated, and that corporations have a vested interest in exaggerating those difficulties. Corporations never have problems with international rules that help corporate interests.
I also would like to add something about a very close friend of ours, Ahmet Çalık. He's also the kind of partner or the kind of participator of the China-Turkmenistan pipeline. And there's a kind of three partners. There's a Turkmenistan, there's a China, and there's Ahmet Çalık. So the China and the Ahmet Çalık, they invested the equal amount of the millions for this pipeline project. And it's really interesting situation that he's dealing like together with the countries, his company. And I mentioned earlier about this buying the media power over his country, and that happened with the support and the help of the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan, who is running this Islamic party there. And nowadays Ahmet is more or less his right hand, and it seems clearly that they are trying to influence the people through this media and trying to manipulate, you know, the situation there and help, you know, this Erdogan's party to keep the power and grow and go further. And this is the one of these very sad examples that what the collaboration of the dictatorship and the companies can increase, you know, and how they can extend so different ways, that when you earn your money in the dictatorship, when you please the crazy dictator, then finally you are able to buy the power in your own country, and also taking over the media and influence the whole situation in your own society. And very much the similar situation in France together through this Bouygues company, and the head of the Bouygues, he is a close friend of the of the Sarkozy, the president of the France. And for instance, Sarkozy is the godfather of the Martin Buick's son. And now they are changing the TV law, or Sarkozy is changing the TV law in order to help TF1, which is owned by the Buick, to getting the power and more, once again, getting this media influence over the people. And it's clearly Sarkozy is going to use that. And this kind of strange combination and influence which is spreading around, you know, when we let these things happen, it's going around and really spoiling the world in many, many levels. Just one thing about the film, unfortunately we saw the short version of the film because of the time limits. The normal version is 90 minutes, and this was more or less, you know, the TV version for some countries. The longer version is more comical. We have more Kevin's phone calls, and I must say that the inspiration to use the irony in the film was coming to Farid and his work, and how they was using the irony to bringing this horrible material to people through these animations. And also Farid has been written this great, you know, the short ironical stories about his country.
Я тогда очень коротко отвечу.
I'll say a few words very quickly in response.
Конечно, тщательно, если бы появился некий международный документ, в котором оговариваются хотя бы минимальные стандарты этики бизнеса.
Of course, it would be fantastic if there was some sort of a international document that was created that had at least some sort of minimal standard, ethical standard for conducting business.
Это было бы вообще хорошо. Что касается первого вопроса, Туркменистан, к сожалению, к моему сожалению, занимает все большее значение в международной политике.
That would be fantastic. In response to the first question, unfortunately, or at least unfortunately, from my standpoint, from my viewpoint, Turkmenistan currently is becoming more and more influential or more and more important in international politics.
Большие запасы газа и к ним проявляет интерес Евросоюз. Близость к афганской границе к этому проявляет интерес как Соединенные Штаты.
Gas resources, large gas resources, are of great interest to the European Union. The closeness to Afghanistan is of great interest both to the United States and to NATO as a whole.
И эти интересы позволяют или вынуждают властям этих стран закрывать глаза на те проблемы, которые существуют в Туркменистане.
And these interests, they allow or maybe force the countries, these outside countries, to ignore the problems of human rights that are endemic in Turkmenistan.
Здесь, правда, мы уже переходим на другой уровень. Здесь уже как бы не вина бизнеса или бизнесменов, а здесь уже речь идет о политиках.
Although here, of course, we're raising the question to a different level. This isn't something that is a fault of business or business leaders. This, of course, now we're talking about countries and political leaders. Thank you.
We have time for one last question. This gentleman in the front. And if you could please use the microphone and don't forget to give your name and affiliation.
I can run through four if you let me. Art Springer, I'm a retired editor and person with an interest in human rights. First question, when was the picture of the Clintons taken? Before, during, or after the Clinton administration? The second question is Turkmenistan's foreign policy. Is it a significant military threat to anyone around it? What is the state of its nuclear technology, and is its foreign policy essentially controlled by the Soviet Union? The last point on the PR firms, that interests me, because the last time I heard that was during the Kuwait episode when a Virginia PR firm was circulating all sorts of lies about what was happening in Kuwait City, and I can't remember how they were exposed, but I do believe they were an unregistered foreign agent. I would suspect the corporations are doing it now rather than the government directly, but it would be nice to pin that down.
I can take the first one. The picture was taken during the Clinton's administration, during his time, and Boris Sikhmuradov Senior, he used to be like 10 years the foreign minister of the Turkmenistan, and that's why he had also great opportunity to create great relationship with many people, and that was during that time. And by the way, we don't have any information about his situation, not even in the Berdi Muhammedov's time. Once Berdi Muhammedov announced that he might be alive, but then he hasn't ever get back in this story, and that's funny that he slipped this thing out, but hasn't done anything since.
For the other questions, let me just take those. For the military threat, I've never seen any information that would indicate that Turkmenistan is a military threat to anybody else in the region. Quite the opposite. It seems that any facilities that it has that could possibly be considered military are simply turned against the people of Turkmenistan themselves and not turned outwards to the rest of the world. Niyazov very deliberately, very consistently, it was one of the few truly consistent things about him as a leader, pursued a policy of neutrality. He was very proud of that policy. It does not appear that Berdi Muhammadov is interested in a particularly different approach. As a matter of fact, Berdi Muhammadov appears to be continuing a similar approach of trying to set off different powers against each other. So also in response to your question about the Soviet, about Russia and whether Russia controls the Turkmen foreign policy, Russia has a large influence to the extent that Russia is such an important partner through Gazprom and such an important military presence in the region. However, Berdi Muhammadov has specialized during the 2 years of his reign so far in attempting to create very strong relations with China, for instance. And after his first big meeting with China, he and the Chinese leadership issued a joint statement where they said that Turkmenistan and China stood shoulder to shoulder on the issue of human rights, and that in particular they both felt very strongly that nations outside of China and Turkmenistan with different cultural traditions had no business whatsoever criticizing their cultural tradition. And I would say this is typical both of the old Niyazov foreign policy and of Berdi Muhammadov's approach so far, to the extent that we can see it in 2 years, a desire to try to find other partners that could possibly counterbalance the unbelievable natural influence that Russia has there. For nuclear technology, I some other people might know differently. I have never, ever seen any kind of information about that whatsoever. It seems to me that militarily the most important thing about Turkmenistan is what I think that journalist mentioned earlier, simply its proximity to Afghanistan, its proximity to Iran, but right now particularly Afghanistan with Obama's commitment to increasing military activity in Afghanistan. It will be a great challenge and something to watch closely to see how Obama decides to treat Turkmenistan. So far, there's only been formal letters back and forth between. Berdi Muhammadov's letter congratulated Obama on his victory. Obama's letter said that Obama looked forward to working with Berdi Muhammadov on those issues where they could work together. So typical political empty talk. We don't have any idea what it amounts to. But the person who said earlier that practical common sense tells you that Turkmenistan's influence and ability to negotiate with the United States government from a position of strength, Berdi Muhammadov's position of strength, is certainly on the rise from a common sense viewpoint.
I need to add about China and Berdi Muhammadov. Berdi Muhammadov was visiting the Olympic Games in Beijing, and he was so excited about the opening ceremony that he immediately met the people who constructed and made this great ceremony, and he was started to plan to build the Olympic village to the Ashgabat, to the Turkmenistan. So now we just need to wait to see, you know, the Olympic, great Olympic Games in Turkmenistan. At least he's planning for that.
And then we can engage with the International Olympic Committee and all the Olympic sponsors on Turkmenistan. Something to look forward to. No, I'm just...
trying to help.
Just picking up on the theme of irony. I'd like to invite Fareed to comment, and he's actually heading to Washington to bring some of these concerns and issues to the attention of the new staff from the new administration there. And in terms of how the president of Turkmenistan plays his cards, I would just note that he managed to negotiate a higher price for the gas that Turkmenistan supplies to Russia. So nobody's fool in that respect. Tough negotiator.
Сейчас к последнему вопросу. У Туркменистана нет, конечно, ядерного оружия. У него есть оружие посильнее ядерного. Вот это.
Just going back to the last question, of course, Turkmenistan has no nuclear weapons. It has even stronger weapons, which is the Rukhnama right there.
И с моей предстоящей поездки в Вашингтон, конечно, я благодарю организаторов этой поездки за предстоящий визит. Важно.
And I'd like to thank the organizers of my trip to Washington. I'm hoping and expecting that it's going to be a very fruitful and positive trip, and I'm going to use some of the comments and questions that I've heard today in my presentation, my dialogue with the representatives in Washington.
Кроме того, моя организация готовит доклады как в целом по правам человека, так и по масс-медиа и все результаты.
And my organization presents, pardon me, presents reports not only on the state of human rights in general as a whole, but also on specific issues, for example, the issue of education, the freedom of the press, etc. And I'm going to present those reports to the representatives of the new administration.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to wrap up. I want to take this opportunity to thank Masha and OSI for organizing this event, thank the panelists for everything that they brought to the discussion, and all of you for coming. And please, let's all wish Fareed well in Washington.